The Strange Story of A. Hinzeman by Anita Silvani. Second edition 1908. The Story of A. Hinzeman, told by himself. Part I. Sowing the Seed _. Chapter 1. The Days of Boyhood. My earliest recollections are of a lonely herdsman's hut among the Caucasian mountains, where, under the care of my foster parent and amidst the peaceful obscurity of my humble surroundings, my childhood's days were passed. None knew who my father was, nor whence I came. I had been brought to the valley as an infant of scarcely a month old by a Persian, whom the shepherd and his wife had nursed when badly wounded 2 years before, and who had passed through their valley with a few of his soldier companions. Little was known even of this man, but from his dress and costly armor it was judged that he must belong to the higher ranks of the king's army. He had brought me himself, unaccompanied by anyone, and had left a large bag of money to pay for the cost of my maintenance, saying that so long as I was well cared for and kindly treated, my foster parents should never want for flocks and herds of their own to tend, nor gold with which to dower their children, but that no attempt must be made to learn whose son I was, nor why I was thus given into the care of strangers. Twice after that this man came to inquire after me, and to see that I was thriving well in that wild mountain valley, and then for several years he came no more. However, as far more than sufficient money had been left with me to provide for all my wants, no great surprise was felt at this. Indeed, the gold given had been so considerable a sum that from a humble tender of other men's flocks my foster father was able to purchase a fine flock of his own, and to remove from the tent where he had dwelt to the little stone building, which I remember, and which, though it seems but a poor humble place to my thoughts now, was yet the summit of his ambition. Thus he and his wife had every reason to tend me well. They had a numerous progeny of their own, some older and some younger than myself, but by them, even in our childish games, I was always treated with a certain degree of deference, as being of a superior rank to themselves. And thus I learnt early to rule, even in my small world, and to exact from others a submission to my wishes, which did much to develop in me that love of command which I had inherited from my royal ancestors. Apart from these considerations, I had certain peculiarities of taste and temper, which served to widen the barrier between myself and those whose care supplied low me that love of kindred that I have never known. I was a strange wayward boy, subject to violent bursts of passion, and full of vague longings for I knew not what, striving always for some state of happiness that was for me unattainable, thirsting ever for more knowledge, and fretting against the narrow limits of my little world. When I grew wearied of the rough games of my companions, and tired of watching the habits of the many animals my foster parents reared, I would wander away by myself into the mountain passes of that half-cultivated land, and throwing myself down upon some grassy mountain top would watch the clouds and sky and glorious sun, until the lonely and desolate region around would appear to grow instinct with life, and myriad forms of every kind of aerial beings would people the solitude, moving around me and floating between me and the rising or setting sun, for it was at early dawn or sunset that I beheld these shapes most often and most clearly. Again at noonday, as I watched the clouds sail over the sky, their shapes would change for me into castles and palaces and wondrous oceans with white-winged ships and huge galleys sailing across, into huntsmen and horses, into warriors engaged in battle, into horses and hounds and swift antelopes. Whole panoramas would unroll themselves before my eyes, until it was no longer cloud shapes I was watching but the wonders of a celestial world. Then when darkness fell, and I lay in my little room, I would behold a glorious star, like unto one of the stars of heaven, that would seem to approach nearer and nearer to me, and expand, till my whole room was bathed in its silver light, and I myself enveloped in its dazzling brightness. In the heart of the star I would see the most radiant angels, their white and glistening robes shining as though powdered with silver dust, and in their hands they would bear wreaths of silver palm, with blue and white flowers. Troops of bright peris or spirit children would assemble and dance around me in the light of the star. Lovely maidens with long floating tresses of hair and snow-white arms would glide in and out before me in all the mazes of the most graceful dances I have ever beheld. Soft strains of music would float to me, borne by some passing zephyr from the spirit land, and lovely glimpses of scenery like unto the white and glistening regions of some fairyland of the blessed would appear to my eyes for a few moments, and then fade away to give place to another scene of delight. Then on a sudden, my star would grow pale and dim, and vanish, leaving me alone in the darkness once more. When I was between 10 and 12 years old, my visions took a new shape. Instead of seeing such troops of spirit forms, I began to see only one, a woman, a very lovely woman, almost like a girl, whose presence seemed to move my heart with a strange feeling of emotion, between the most intense sorrow and the greatest joy. While she was visible, I felt happy. When she faded away, I felt as though the light of my life had gone with her, and I would be seized with an intense longing to break free from my earthly body and follow her. At first she would appear to lie floating in the heart of the silver star, as though she were asleep. Her eyes were closed and her head drooped upon her shoulder, while her arms hung limp and powerless at her side. Her face was the most lovely one imaginable, and a great wealth of dark hair hung loosely on her shoulders. On her head she wore a single silver star, and in the heart of this star there was a drop of crimson dew, like a ruby, while her white robes are bordered by silver stars, and below them there came a border of crimson, that seemed to me at first to flow from two red spots, one on her neck and the other on her shoulder. She neither smiled nor spoke to me for a long time, but her presence always woke in me the same strange emotion, and her coming must have stopped that of the other spirit forms, for I saw them no more. The scenery would be there at times, the troops of dancing children, never. Again and again I saw her, and at last one day her eyes opened and she appeared to be awake, for she gazed at me with wondering dark eyes, strangely like my own. By degrees she grew more and more awake, and would smile sweetly at me, and then one night she drew near and touched me. But oh, with what painful emotion her touch filled my soul. I wept in bitterest anguish, and my tears caused the star to fade and she vanished away, and not for long did I behold her again. For long I kept these visions to myself. I shrank instinctively from sharing my secret with anyone, but at last I told my foster mother, and she was much disturbed by my recital, fearing that my beholding these things must portend the death of someone, or trouble of some sort. She also feared there must be something unearthly and strange about me, and in her anxiety, she first gossiped about the matter with all her neighbors, and then decided to consult the priests of a little hill temple 5 miles away, built upon one of the highest mountains where it could catch the first and last rays of the rising and setting sun. By the priests she was somewhat reassured as to my probable origin, which she had begun to fear must be due to the influence of some of the genii, and that possible I was not mortal after all. She was advised to bring me with her, that they might judge for themselves whether my visions were of the delusions of Ahriman and his fallen angels, or whether they were truly sent from the angelic spheres and betokened the possession of prophetic powers. In this way I was first brought under the notice of these priests, and amongst them I soon found a congenial friend in the person of one of the brothers of the humbler order of priesthood. He was a man of about 40 years of age, an enthusiast and a visionary, and one well calculated to develop in me all these strange powers of divination I had inherited from my mother. By this priest I was taught to read and write in Azend characters, and to decipher the hieroglyphics upon the rolls of illuminated sheepskin whereon were recorded the histories of other faiths than our own. He taught me also to read the meanings of many of the symbolical pictures carved and painted upon the various vessels in use in the service of the temple. From him I learned also of the teachings of the great Zerdusht or Zoroaster, as some call him, and of the pure doctrines and reformed sect founded by him. He also taught me that it was possible to acquire the art of leaving the earthly body, and wandering at will through the spirit spheres, even as had been done by the great Zerdusht himself in order that he might bring back from thence the teachings of the higher spirits. To do this required a long and severe apprenticeship to spiritual things, and could only be safely practiced by those within the precincts of a temple or other holy sutsi note b. Besides these things he spoke to me of many other mysteries, into which he said it would not be lawful to initiate me unless I had first become one of the neophytes of the temple. He told me that such powers as mine were clearly intended to be dedicated to the service of God, and so worked upon my imagination and enthusiasm for occult things that I was all eagerness to be taken into the temple as he and the other priests advised. This was, however, impossible without the consent of the man who appeared to be my guardian, and matters had to be left in abeyance till he should come again to inquire about my welfare. 2 years passed ere this event, and meanwhile my constant visits to the temple, and the unusual and rare knowledge I was thereby acquiring, and of which I was so proud that I did not keep it to myself, but boasted of it to my companions, had excited the jealousy and anger of our little community. Although my foster parents and their children, from motives of interest and affection, might defer to me and be proud of my learning, it was otherwise with those who had nothing to gain or lose from the favor of my unknown protector, and the neighbors and their sons naturally resented my peculiarities and airs of superiority. I was growing a tall, strong lad, and my quick temper and overbearing ways towards those I deemed my inferiors, made me more enemies than friends. First it was said that I was clearly the offspring of some intrigue, since my parents were ashamed to acknowledge me, truly a pretty fellow to give himself airs over them. Then when my visions were known and talked about by my foster mother, it was said I must be the child of some of the genii, and not mortal at all, that the simple Abukir and his wife had been imposed upon by this stranger, who, they averred, had doubtless foisted some changeling upon them. Vague stories of all kinds began to circulate. It was said I had been seen wandering about the hills after dark, which was in part true, and that it was true I belonged to the class of ghouls and vampires. The hour and the day on which I had been brought to the village were found to be unlucky, and marked with a black stone, and all the misfortunes of the tribe were attributed to my influence, since it was thought I possessed the evil eye. Ere long I began to be avoided by one and all, and though the good priest, on hearing of these stories, called upon the headman of the tribe and told him I was destined to the service of the temple, his visit only served to make the stories against me to be whispered instead of spoken aloud to all the world. At first I felt most bitterly hurt by these things, and all the philosophic consolations bestowed upon me by my friend the priest Abubatha failed to comfort me. Then my pride awoke, my imperious temper asserted itself, and I repaid their dislike with tenfold contempt and scorn. Thus I became more solitary in my ways than ever, for ill-natured gossip once started is not easily laid to rest, and the gulf between myself and my fellows became only wider as time passed on. Chapter 2. The Two Strangers. I was 13 years old when the man who had brought me to this valley came again, and my foster father Abukir told him of my visions and my visits to the priests in the temple, but of the whispered stories against me he said no word, fearing that he should be deprived in consequence of the care of me. The stranger pondered the matter over for a short time, and then sent for me to speak with him. But I could not be found, as I had gone away upon one of my long rambles over the mountains, and the stranger left, promising to return shortly. A few weeks after this, when I was alone in the house, my foster father having gone to attend some distant flocks, and my foster mother, to gossip with her neighbors, I was aroused from my studies by hearing the trampling of horses' feet, and looking out I beheld two horsemen dismounting at our door. Their rich dresses and richly caparisoned steeds proclaimed them to be of higher rank. One was a rather short but very broad-shouldered and powerful-looking man, whom I had no trouble in recognizing from my foster parents' description as the mysterious stranger who had brought me there. The other was much taller and more slender, though also a powerful-looking man. His face was partly covered by a thick black beard, and his expression was, even to my childish eyes, very sad and grave. The beauty of the horses greatly attracted me, for I was very fond of all animals, but especially of horses, and I had early learned to ride and to excel in all the simple feats of horsemanship practiced by the hill tribes, who are largely engaged in rearing horses as well as sheep and goats. But I had never seen such beautiful horses as these, such graceful, pretty creatures, that stood arching their glossy necks and tossing their long manes and pawing the ground in their impatience, and I drew near the tall stranger's horse to stroke and caress it, staring at the two men with wondering eyes as I did so. "Where are the herdsmen Abukir and his wife?" asked the short stranger. I told him, and said I would go and fetch them, but he stopped me, and said it did not matter, for that it was the boy Erinzaman they had come to see. All this time I was stroking the horse and patting it, and it seemed to like my touch, for it grew quiet under it. The short stranger noticed this, and added, "You art a bold boy surely, to be so ready to touch another man's horse." "I am not afraid of anything," said I, frowning at him, for I liked not his tone of banter. "See the, oh sire." "Whom did the boy resemble then?" said the short man. "We need no herdsman's wife to tell us whose son this is." "You are right," answered the other, and then he added with a sigh, "He is like her also. He had her eyes, surely he will be like her in other ways." Then turning to me he said, "Wouldst you like to be a soldier, since you dost fear no man?" "I had rather be a priest, for then I should live in the temple, and no one would dare to jeer at me. All men would pay me respect. I would be a priest and a prophet like unto the great Zerdusht, and all men would do homage to my powers. I would not be a soldier, for a soldier has always to obey orders. There is ever one above him. Even the commander must obey the king, and I would not bow to any man. Rather would I have all men hearken unto me." The short man laughed. "Behold," said he, "how loudly he crows already." But the other answered me gravely, "How dost you know, Ahinziman, that you couldst become a great prophet? Are there not many within the temples whose lives are ever humble? There had been but one Zerdusht. How can your ambition make you think to become as great as he?" "Because the priest Abubatha says that since the days of Zerdusht there have been few who beheld the things of the spirit world with the clear eyes with which I see them. He thinks that were I to devote myself now to the service of the temple I might become almost as great a seer as Zerdusht. Who knows but that I would surely become as great as he, when I am as old as he was when he began to prophesy." "You art not wanting in ambition, truly, O Ahinziman. Yet tell me of the visions of which you dost speak, that we may judge from whence they come." Then I told him of all those things which I had seen, of the lovely spirits and the bright star and the glowing pictures, and last I told him of the white angel, as I called her. He questioned me much concerning her, and seemed much agitated when I told him how she had looked at first, and when I spoke of the two red spots that gave the red bordering to her robes his face darkened with anger as well as sorrow, and he clenched his hands and appeared moved to much passion. Then I told him that of late the red spots were gone, although the red border remained, and that she was awake now and smiled on me, and had touched me once, but that her touch gave me suffering and pain, although I longed always for her to come to me again. And when I told him this he put his hand upon my shoulder, and bade me look up at him and tell it all to him once more. And as I did so he kept his hand upon me, as though to assure himself who it was that was speaking to him. As I finished my recital for the second time a sudden impulse caused me to clasp his hand in mine, and raising it to my lips I kissed it passionately. It was as though for that instant the most intense love for him took possession of my soul, and I could have embraced him and wept over him in mingled joy and sorrow. But he was a stranger to me, and I was afraid, and the impulse passed away. As I kissed his hand he cried out in agitation, "God of my fathers!" That was her action exactly. That was her way with me. And he took his hand from me and covered his face with his mantle as he turned away. Yet I could tell that he was weeping, for he spoke not, but strode back and forth as though wrestling with his sorrow, while the other man walked away from us into the house, as though in respect to his emotions. After a little while the tall stranger came back to me, and taking a thick richly wrought gold chain from his neck he flung it over my head, saying, "Show that to your white angel when she comes again, and ask her if she has no word, no sign, to give me." Then he kissed me many times, embracing me with much tenderness, while I clung to him and prayed that he would take me with him, though I knew not who he was. But he put me away at last and turned to summon his friend, saying to me, "Not yet, O beloved child of my lost Cynthia, not yet. But soon shall you come unto me and be the comfort of my sad days. Then they went forth and mounted their horses and rode away, while I stood looking after them, and especially after that old stranger who turned to look at me many times, till a bend in the mountain pass hid them from my sight. Then I went into the house, and on the table I found a bag of gold and a message written, which I could now read, to say that nothing was to be done till the strangers came again, and I guessed it had been left by the short man while we were speaking. Chapter 3, I enter the temple. During many weeks we looked for the return of the strangers, but they came not. But I saw my white angel again. She came one night and stood smiling and looking upon me from the heart of the silver star. Then, she drew near to me, and though she did not touch me, she raised the chain, which I had always worn since the tall stranger gave it to me, to her lips and kissed it, and I thought she said, "Tell him that," and she faded away again, and was lost in the light of the silver star. Soon after, the stranger's visit. The monotony of our life was broken by the arrival in our village of one of the tribesmen who had gone to fight in the Sultan's army, and who now returned too crippled to serve any longer. He brought with him much treasure, plundered no doubt, during the time of service, and he soon established himself in a fine tent with a wife, whose dress and ornaments became the envy of all her neighbors. And he also bought a fine flock of sheep and goats. Chance brought me across this man, although as a rule I avoided the village, and very soon a kind of friendship sprang up between us, for the man had many strange tales to tell of his adventurous wanderings, and the exciting scenes of war, and I was greedy for all stories of that world, which lay beyond our mountains, and of which I thought much oftener since the visit of the two strangers. I had begun to waver in my desire to be a prophet, and as I listened to the tales told by the soldier, my imagination became fired at the thought of the stirring life a soldier led, and the strange countries and people that he saw, and but for the influence of my friend Abubatha over me, I should have thought seriously of changing my ambition, and adopting a more exciting life than that of a prophet. In truth, I was but little fitted to form a right judgment upon the merits of either mode of life. Nearly 6 months passed, and then one evening a hurried messenger arrived upon a weary horse, bringing a ring, which they remembered the short stranger to have worn, and a message that the ring was sent in token of the authority of the messenger, and was to be kept until the owner came himself to claim it, and they were to lose no time in placing me within the precincts of the temple. Then the man rode away again, and thus was my fate decided. The next day I was taken to the temple, and formally received by my friend and the other priests. And after all, instead of hailing this event with joy, as I should have done some months before, I felt instead a feeling of disappointment and foreboding of some sorrow. I did not enjoy the happiness of my beloved friend's society long. Within a year from my admission to the temple, he died quite suddenly, leaving me once more without one congenial friend. I had thought he would at least come back to me from the shadow land, as my white angel came, but I never saw him, and not till I myself passed over to the world of spirits did I learn why. The other priests were kind to me, but not the sympathetic friends that Abubatha had been, and I lost my spirits and grew very sad after his death. Then there came another change, and for me a harder one still. I was sent, why, I was not told, from the little mountain temple to the far larger and far more important one of Amirat. And there began for me a long and weary and monotonous period, which, were I to describe it in detail, would but weary those who read my story. This temple of Amirat was a very different place to the little lonely one amongst the mountains of the Caucasus, and its priests were far more wealthy and autocratic than the humble, kindly men I had known, and once fairly dedicated to the service of God. I found life to be a very different thing from what it had been during the pleasant, friendly intercourse I had held with my beloved friend. A severe regimen of lonely vigils and prolonged fasts was imposed upon me, the great object of my training being to subdue the desires of the flesh and turn my mind from all earthly thoughts to the contemplation of heavenly things. For this purpose all intercourse with the world outside the temple walls was prohibited to me. Had my friend Abubatha been alive, I should not have felt this to be so great a privation, but I had no sympathy with any of these priests, and I yearned so intensely to see my friend again, that this, and the severe strain of the training imposed upon a growing lad, caused my health to give way, and I became so seriously and even dangerously ill, that my instructors were obliged to relax their rules and suspend my development for a considerable time, and allow me to wander freely about within the precincts of the temple. To go outside the walls was impossible, the great gates being only open to admit egress or ingress of the processions of the priests, and those who, like myself, were reserved as the mediums through whom the oracles were to be given, were never allowed to join in them, and seldom even to mix with each other, that we might thereby impair the purity of our gift by absorbing the ideas of someone on earth. We were only allowed to see the priests, men, who not possessing the power of divination themselves were yet the instructors and regulators of the lives and visions of those hapless sensitives who possessed these gifts. During the period of my illness my visions departed or became so confused as to be valueless, and when I returned to health I found that they had assumed a new form. My white angel and the troops of dancers I never more beheld, but instead I would see grave majestic men in priestly robes, bearing long scrolls in their hands, who showed me the answers to questions asked of them by the earthly priests by means of pictures and by messages conveyed in symbolical language, scarcely understood by myself, but whose meanings were interpreted by the priests, and, I am very certain, often wrongly interpreted and distorted to suit their own peculiar idiosyncrasies, and to dovetail into their own theories. That my powers were very great was fully recognized, and, I was therefore more completely isolated from my companions than ever in order that no influence from them might blend with the oracles given through me, a wise precaution theoretically, but one whose usefulness was greatly nullified by the constant presence and influence around the clairvoyance of these strong-minded positive-eyed priests, with their fixed theories concerning most things, and their desire to make all revelations coincide with them. They forgot that their ideas were even more likely than those of my fellow neophytes to color my visions and interpose a barrier between my clear sight and the spirit communications. Another mistake they made was taking these clairvoyants into the temples before they had acquired any knowledge of the true relations of material life, and imagining that ignorance was necessarily purity of thought. Innocence and ignorance are often synonymous, but the innocence, which springs only from ignorance, is but a poor shield against the influence of evil powers. These ignorant beings might be like children in innocence, but they were also like them in mental development, and had all the failings and weakness of children as well as their virtues, all the illogical imperfect standards of judging things, and all the undisciplined unregulated passions. And like children, or half-developed souls, they could only come into direct communication with the spirits of the Silver Star, whose own ignorance of mundane affairs did not fit them to become very wise counselors. The influence of the mortal priests might indeed give more practical bias to these imperfect revelations, but their influence did not come from the spirit side of life, and only served to confuse what did. Hence arose that condition of error and confusion, which as time went on, became so marked as to discredit the oracles altogether, and led to the final overthrow of those systems of religion of which they formed so important a part. The prophets who led a more natural life and mingled with their fellow men might, and often did, color their prophecies with the thought emanations of those around them, but their visions, being drawn from the practical experiences of life, were of a certain practical value, though, owing to the fact that prophets who could thus mingle freely with other men, were not of the highest order - their source of inspiration was limited to the first and second spheres, and their visions were therefore far from being as beautiful and elevated as those of the mystics secluded within the temples. The spiritual laws, which govern the various forms of divination, and which explain the causes of the different degrees of power, I shall enter into more fully at a later stage of my history, when I had come to understand them more fully myself. To return now to the experiences of my life in this temple, I may point out that a sensitive or medium is of necessity one who feels readily all the influences which prevail around him or her. The material, being the strongest influence, will be felt first and in the most dominant degree. Hence the priests in the temple were themselves responsible for many of the things I saw or heard, and their constant influence about me shut out us with thick veil of materiality, the more spiritual visions, which I had beheld as a child when quite alone,